bushes around him, he can hear two low, tense voices.
"Hell, Oscar," says one voice in Spanish. "Luna, did you tell her? Does she know you're asking me to do this?"
"She's too careful," his father's voice says.
He's speaking Spanish, too, a precaution the two of them occasionally take when they're concerned about being overheard.
"Sometimes it's best that she doesn't know."
There's the sound of a hissing exhale, weight shifting.
"I'm not going behind her back to do something I don't even want to do."
"You mean to tell me, after what Richards did to you, there's not a part of you that wants to burn all his shit to the ground?"
"Of course there is, Oscar. Jesus," Luna says. "But you and I both know it's not that fucking simple. It never is."
"Listen, Raph, I know you kept the files on everything. You don't even have to make a statement. You could leak it to the press. How many other kids do you think since don't? And how many more?
You don't think she can win on her own, do you?"
Luna cuts across him.
"You still don't have faith in her, after everything."
"It's not about that. This time is different.
Why don't you leave me and something that happened 20 fucking years ago out of your unresolved feelings for your ex-wife and focus on winning this goddamn election, Oscar? I don't."
Luna cuts himself off because there's the sound of the doorknob turning, someone entering the offices. Oscar switches to clipped English, making an excuse about discussing a bill, then says to Luna in Spanish,
"Just think about it."
There are muffled sounds of Oscar and Luna clearing out of the office, and Alex sinks down onto his ass in the mulch, wondering what the hell he's missing. It starts with a fundraiser, a silk suit and a big check, a nice white tablecloth event. It starts, as it always does, with a text. "Fundraiser in LA next weekend. Pez says he's going to get us all matching embroidered kimonos. Put you down for a plus two?" He grabs lunch with his dad, who flat out changes the subject every time Alex brings up Luna, and afterward heads to the gala, where Alex gets to properly meet Bee for the first time. She's much shorter than Henry, shorter even than June, with Henry's clever mouth, but their mom's brown hair and heart-shaped face. She's wearing a motorcycle jacket over her cocktail dress and has a slight posture he recognizes from his own mother as a reformed chain smoker. She smiles at Alex, wide and mischievous, and he gets her immediately. Another rebel kid. It's a lot of champagne and too many handshakes and a speech by Pez, charming as always, and as soon as it's over, their collective security convenes at the exit and they're off. Pez has, as promised, six matching silk kimonos waiting in the limo, each one embroidered across the back with a different riff on a name from a movie. Alex's is a lurid teal and says, "Ho Dameron." Henry's lime green one reads, "Prince Buttercup." They end up somewhere in West Hollywood at a shitty, sparkling karaoke bar Pez somehow knows about, neon bright enough that it feels spontaneous even though Cash and the rest of their security have been checking it and warning people against taking photos for half an hour before they arrive. The bartender has immaculate pink lipstick and stubble poking through thick foundation, and they rapidly line up five shots and a soda with lime.
"Oh dear," Henry says, peering down into his empty shot glass. "What's in these? Vodka?"
"Yep,"
Nora confirms, to which both Pez and B break out into fits of giggle.
"What?" Alex says.
"Oh, I haven't had vodka since uni," Henry says. "It tends to make me, well,
flamboyant," Pez offers, "uninhibited, randy, fun," B suggests.
"Excuse you, I am loads of fun all the time. I am a delight. Hello, excuse me, can we get another round of these, please?"
Alex calls down the bar. B screams, Henry laughs and throws up a V, and it all goes hazy and warm in the way Alex loves. They all tumble into a round booth, and the lights are low, and he and Henry are keeping a safe distance. But Alex can't stop staring at how the special effects beams keep hitting Henry's cheekbones, hollowing his face out in blues and greens. He's something else. Half drunk and grinning in a $2,000 suit and a kimono, and Alex can't tear his eyes away. He waves over a beer. Once things get going, it's impossible to tell how B is the one persuaded up to the stage first. But she unearths a plastic crown from the prop chest on stage and rips through a cover of Call Me by Blondie. They all wolf whistle and cheer, and the bar crowd finally realizes they've got two members of the royal family, a millionaire philanthropist and the White House trio crammed into one of the sticky booths in a rainbow of vivid silk. Three rounds of shots appear, one from a drunk bachelorette party, one from a herd of slurry butch chicks at the bar, and one from a table of drag queens. They raise a toast, and Alex feels more welcomed than he ever has before, even at his family's victory rallies. Pez gets up and launches into So Emotional by Whitney Houston in a shockingly flawless falsetto that has the whole club on their feet in a matter of moments, shouting their approval as he belts out the glory notes. Alex looks over in giddy awe at Henry, who laughs and shrugs. "I told you, there's nothing he can't do," he shouts over the noise. June is watching the whole performance with her hands clapped to her face, her mouth hanging open, and she leans over to Nora and drunkenly yells, "Oh no, he's so hot."
"I know, babe," Nora yells back. "I want to put my fingers in his mouth,"
she moans, sounding horrified. Nora cackles and nods appreciatively and says, "Can I help?" B, who has gone through five different lime and soda so far, politely passes over a shot that's been handed to her as Pez pulls June up on stage and Alex throws it back. The burn makes his smile and his legs spread a little wider, and his phone is in his hand before he registers sliding it out of his pocket. He texts Henry under the table.
"Wanna do something stupid?"
He watches Henry pull his own phone out, grin, and arch a brow over at him.
"What could be stupider than this?"
Henry's mouth falls open into a very unflattering expression of drunken, bewildered arousal, like a hot halibut, at his reply several beats later. Alex smiles and leans back into the booth, making a show of wrapping wet lips around the bottle of his beer. Henry looks like his entire life might be flashing before his eyes, and he says, an octave too high, "Right, well, I'll just nip to the loo." And he's off, while the rest of the group is still caught up in Pez and June's performance. Alex gives it to the count of 10 before slipping past Nora and following. He swaps a glance with Cash, who's standing against one wall, gamely wearing a bright pink feather boa. He rolls his eyes, but peels off to watch the door. Alex finds Henry leaning against the sink, arms folded.
"Have I mentioned lately that you're a demon?"
Yeah. Alex says, double-checking the coast is clear before grabbing Henry by the belt and backing into a stall. "Tell me again later."
You know this is still not convincing me to sing, don't you?"
Henry chokes out as Alex mouths along his throat.
"You really think it's a good idea to present me with a challenge, sweetheart?"
Which is how, 30 minutes and two more rounds later, Henry is in front of a screaming crowd, absolutely butchering "Don't Stop Me Now" by Queen, while Nora sings backup and B throws glittery gold roses at his feet. His kimono is dangling off one shoulder, so the embroidery across the back reads, "Prince Butt." Alex does not know where the roses came from, but he can't imagine asking would get him anywhere. He also wouldn't be able to hear the answer because he's been screaming at the top of his lungs for 2 minutes straight.
"I wanna make a supersonic woman of you," Henry shouts, lunging violently sideways, catching Nora by both arms. "Don't stop me! Don't stop me! Don't stop me!"
"Hey, hey, hey!" the entire bar yells back. Pez is practically on top of the table now, pounding the back of the booth with one hand and helping June up onto a chair with the other.
"Don't stop me! Don't stop me!"
Alex cups his hand around his mouth. "Ooh, ooh, ooh!" In a cacophony of shouting and kicking and pelvic thrusting and flashing lights, the song blasts into the guitar solo, and there's not a single person in the bar in their seat. Not when a Prince of England is knee-sliding across the stage, playing passionate and somewhat erotic air guitar. Nora has produced a bottle of champagne and starts spraying Henry with it, and Alex loses his mind laughing, climbs on top of his seat, and wolf whistles. B is absolutely beside herself, tears streaming down her face, and Pez actually is on top of the table now, June dancing beside him with a bright fuchsia smear of lipstick in his platinum hair. Alex feels a tug on his arm, B dragging him down to the stage. She grabs his hand and spins him in a ballerina twirl, and he puts one of her roses between his teeth, and they watch Henry and grin at each other through the noise. Alex feels somewhere, under the 50 layers of booze, something crystal clear radiating off her. A shared knowledge of how rare and wonderful this version of Henry is. Henry is yelling into the microphone again, stumbling to his feet, his suit and kimono stuck to him with champagne and sweat in a confusingly sexy mess. His eyes flick upward, hazy and hot, and unmistakably lock with Alex's at the edge of the stage, smiling broad and messy. I want to make a supersonic man out of you. By the end, there's a standing ovation awaiting him. And B, with a steady hand and a devilish smile, ruffling his champagne sticky hair. She steers him into the booth and Alex's side, and he pulls her in after him, and the six of them fall together in a tangle of hoarse laughter and expensive shoes. He looks at all of them. Pez, his broad smile and glowing joy, the way his white blonde hair flashes against smooth, dark skin. The curve of Bee's waist and hip and her punk rock grin as she sucks on the rind of a lime. Nora's long legs, one of which is propped on the table, and the other crossed over one of Bee's. Her thigh bare where her dress has ridden up. And Henry, flushed and callow and lean, elegant and thrown wide open. His face always turned toward Alex, his mouth unguarded around a laugh, willing. He turns to June and slurs, "Bisexuality is truly a rich and complex tapestry." And she screams with laughter and shoves a napkin in his mouth. Alex doesn't catch much of the next hour. The back of the limo, Nora and Henry jostling for a spot in his lap, an in-and-out drive-thru, and June screaming next to his ear, "Animal style! Did you hear me say animal style? Stop fucking laughing, Pez!" There's the hotel, three suites booked for them on the very top floor, riding through the lobby on Cash's impossibly broad back. June keeps shushing them as they stumble to their rooms with hands full of grease-soaked burger bags, but she's louder than any of them, so it's a zero-sum game. B, perpetually the lone, sober voice of the group, picks one of the suites at random and deposits June and Nora in the king-size bed, and Pez in the empty bathtub. "I trust you two can handle yourselves," she says to Alex and Henry in the hallway, a glimmer of mischief in her eyes as she hands them the third key. "I fully intend to put on a robe and investigate this French fries dipped in milkshake thing Nora told me about."
"Yes, Beatrice, we shall behave in a manner befitting the crown," Henry says.
His eyes are slightly crossed.
"Don't be a tosser," she says, and quickly kisses them both on the cheek before vanishing around the corner.
Henry's laughing into the curls at the nape of Alex's neck by the time Alex is fumbling the door open, and they stumble together into the wall and then toward the bed, clothes dropping in their wake. Henry smells like expensive cologne and champagne, and a distinctly Henry smell that never goes away, clean and grassy, and his chest encompasses Alex's back when he crowds up behind him at the edge of the bed, splaying his hands over his hips.
"Supersonic man out of you,"
Alex mumbles low, craning his head back into Henry's ear, and Henry laughs and kicks his knees out from under him. It's a clumsy, sideways tumble into bed, both of them grabbing greedy handfuls of the other, Henry's pants still dangling from one ankle. But it doesn't matter because Henry's eyes are fluttered shut and Alex is finally kissing him again. His hands start traveling south on instinct, sweet muscle memory of Henry's body against his, until Henry reaches down to stop him.
"Hold on, hold on," Henry says. "I'm just realizing. All that earlier, and you haven't gotten off yet tonight, have you?"
He drops his head back on the pillow, regards him with narrowed eyes.
"Well, that just shall not do."
"Hmm, yeah," Alex says. He takes advantage of the moment to kiss the column of Henry's throat, the hollow at his collarbone, the knot of his Adam's apple.
What are you going to do about it?
Henry pushes a hand into his hair and gives it a little pull.
I shall just have to make it the best orgasm of your life. What can I do to make it good for you? Talk about American tax reform during the act? Have you got talking points?
Alex looks up, and Henry is grinning at him.
I hate you. Maybe some light lacrosse role play?
He's laughing now, arms coming up around Alex's shoulders to squeeze him to his chest.
Oh, Captain, my Captain.
You're literally the worst, Alex says, and undercuts it by leaning up to kiss him once more. Gently, then deeply, long and slow and heated. He feels Henry's body shifting beneath his, opening up.
Hang on, Henry says, breaking off breathlessly. Wait.
Alex opens his eyes, and when he looks down, the expression on Henry's face is a more familiar one. Nervous, unsure.
I do actually, have an idea.
He slides a hand up Henry's chest to the side of his jaw, ghosting over his cheek with one finger.
Hey, he says, serious now. I'm listening. For real.
Henry bites his lip, visibly searching for the right words, and apparently comes to a decision.
Come here,
he says, surging up to kiss Alex, and he's putting his whole body into it now, sliding his hands down to palm at Alex's ass as he kisses him. Alex feels a sound tear itself from his throat, and he's following Henry's lead blindly now, kissing him deep into the mattress, riding a continuous wave of Henry's body. He feels Henry's thighs, those goddamn horseback-riding, polo-playing thighs, moving around him. Soft, warm skin wrapping around his waist, heels pressing into his back. When Alex breaks off to look at him, the intention on Henry's face is as plain as anything he's ever read there.
You sure?
I know we haven't, Henry says quietly, but, I have before, so I can show you.
I mean, I'm familiar with the mechanics, Alex says, smirking a little,
and he sees a corner of Henry's mouth quirk up to mirror him.
But you want me to?
Yeah,
he says. He pushes his hips up, and they both make some unflattering, involuntary noises.
Yes, absolutely.
Henry's shaving kit is on the nightstand, and he reaches over and fumbles blindly through it before finding what he's looking for. A condom and a tiny bottle of lube. Alex almost laughs at the sight. Travel-size lube. He's had some experimental sex in his lifetime, but it never occurred to him to consider if such a thing existed, much less if Henry was jetting around with it alongside his dental floss.
This is new.
Yes, well,
Henry says, and he takes one of Alex's hands in his and brings it to his own mouth, kissing his fingertips.
We all must learn and grow, mustn't we?
Alex rolls his eyes, ready to snark, except Henry sucks two fingers into his mouth, very effectively shutting him the hell up. It's incredible and baffling, the way Henry's confidence comes in waves like this, how he struggles so much to get through the asking for what he wants and then readily takes it the moment he's given permission, like at the bar. How the right push had him dancing and shouting as if he'd been waiting for someone to tell him he was allowed to do it. They're not as drunk as they were, but there's enough alcohol in their systems, and it doesn't feel as daunting as it would otherwise, the first time, even as fingers start to find their way. Henry's head falls back onto the pillows, and he closes his eyes and lets Alex take over. The thing about sex with Henry is, it's never the same twice. Sometimes he moves easily, caught up in the rush, and other times he's tense and taut and wants Alex to work him loose and take him apart. Sometimes nothing gets him off faster than being talked back to, but other times, they both want him to use every inch of authority in his blood, not to let Alex get there until he's told, until he begs. It's unpredictable, and it's intoxicating, and it's fun,
because Alex has never met a challenge he didn't love, and he... well, Henry is a challenge, head to toe, beginning to end. Tonight, Henry's silly and warm and ready, his body quick and smooth to give Alex what he's looking for, laughing and incredulous at his own responsiveness to touch. Alex leans down to kiss him, and Henry murmurs into the corner of his mouth,
"Ready when you are, love."
Alex takes a breath, holds it.
He's ready. He thinks he's ready.
Henry's hand comes up to stroke along his jaw, his sweaty hairline, and Alex settles himself between his legs, lets Henry lace the fingers of his right hand with Alex's left. He's watching Henry's face. He can't imagine looking at anything other than Henry's face right now, and his expression goes so soft and his mouth so happy and astonished that Alex's voice speaks without his permission.
A hoarse, "Baby."
Henry nods, so small that someone who didn't know all his tics might miss it, but Alex knows exactly what it means, so he leans down and sucks Henry's earlobe between his lips and calls him baby again. And Henry says,
"Yes," and "Please,"
and tugs his hair at the root. Alex nips at Henry's throat and palms at his hips and sinks into the white-out bliss of being that impossibly close to him, of getting to share his body. Somehow, it still amazes him that all this seems to be as unbelievably, singularly good for Henry as it is for him. Henry's face should be illegal, the way it's turned up toward him, flushed and undone. Alex feels his own lips spreading into a pleased smile, awed and proud. Afterward, he comes back into his own body in increments, his knees still dug into the mattress and shaking, his stomach slick and sticky, his hands twisting up in Henry's hair, stroking it gently. He feels like he's stepped outside of himself and returned to find everything slightly rearranged. When he pulls his face back to look at Henry, the feeling comes back into his chest, an ache in answer to the curve of Henry's top lip over white teeth.
"Jesus Christ,"
Alex says at last, and when he looks over at Henry again, he's squinting at him impishly out of one eye, smirking.
"Would you describe it as supersonic?"
he says. And Alex groans and slaps him across the chest, and they both dissolve into messy laughter. They slide apart and make out and argue over who has to sleep in the wet spot until they pass out around 4 in the morning. Henry rolls Alex onto his side and burrows behind him until he's covering him completely, his shoulders a brace for Alex's shoulders, one of his thighs pressed on top of Alex's thighs, his arms over Alex's arms, and his hands over Alex's hands, nowhere left untouched. It's the best Alex has slept in years. Their alarms go off 3 hours later for their flights home. They shower together. Henry's mood turns dark and sour over morning coffee at the harsh reality of returning to London so soon, and Alex kisses him dumbly and promises to call and wishes there was more he could do. He watches Henry lather up and shave, put pomade in his hair, put on his Burberry for the day, and he catches himself wishing he could watch it every day. He likes taking Henry apart, but there's something incredibly intimate about sitting on the bed they wrecked the night before, the only one who watches him create Prince Henry of Wales for the day. Through his throbbing hangover, he's got a suspicion all those feelings are why he held off on fucking Henry for so long. Also, he might puke. It's probably unrelated. They meet the others in the hallway. Henry passing for hungover, but handsome, and Alex just doing his best. B is looking well-rested, fresh, and very smug about it. June, Nora, and Pez all emerge disheveled from their suite, looking like the cats that caught the canaries, but it's impossible to tell who is a cat and who is a canary. Nora has a smudge of lipstick on the back of her neck. Alex doesn't ask. Cash chuckles under his breath when he meets them at the elevators, a tray of 6 coffees balanced on one hand. Hangover tending isn't part of his job description, but he's a mother hen.
So this is the gang now, huh?
And through it all, Alex realizes with a start, he has friends now. Chapter 8. Subject: You are a dark sorcerer. From Henry H. Wales at kensingtonemail.com, June 8, 2020, 3:23 p.m. 2A. Alex, I can't think of a single other way to start this email except to say, and I do hope you will forgive both my language and my utter lack of restraint, you are so fucking beautiful. I've been useless for a week, driven around for appearances and meetings. Lucky if I've made a single meaningful contribution to any of them. How's a man to get anything done knowing Alex Clermont Diaz is out there on the loose? I am driven to distraction. It's all bloody useless because when I'm not thinking about your face, I'm thinking about your arse, or your hands, or your smart mouth. I suspect the latter is what got me into this predicament in the first place. Nobody's ever got the nerve to be cheeky to a prince, except you. The moment you first called me a prick, my fate was sealed. Oh, fathers of my bloodline, oh, ye kings of old, take this crown from me, bury me in my ancestral soil. If only you had known the mighty work of thine loins would be undone by a gay heir who likes it when American boys with chin dimples are mean to him. Actually, remember those gay kings I mentioned? I feel that James I, who fell madly in love with a very fit and exceptionally dim knight at a tilting match and immediately made him a gentleman of the bedchamber, a real title, would take mercy upon my particular plight. I'll be damned, but I miss you. Kisses, Henry. Subject, re, you are a dark sorcerer. From A, AGCD, at eclair45.com. June 8, 2020, 5:02 p.m. To Henry. H. Are you implying that you're James the First and I'm some hot dumb jock? I'm more than fantastic bone structure and an ass you can bounce a quarter on, Henry. Don't apologize for calling me pretty, because then you're putting me in a position where I have to apologize for saying you blew my fucking mind in L.A. and I'm gonna die if it doesn't happen again soon. How's that for lack of restraint, huh? You really want to play that game with me? Listen, I'll fly to London right now and pull you out of whatever pointless meeting you're in and make you admit how much you love it when I call you baby. I'll take you apart with my teeth, sweetheart. Kisses and hugs, Alex. Subject, re, you are a dark sorcerer. From Henry, H. Wales at kensingtonemail.com, June 8, 2020, 7:21 p.m., 2A. Alex, you know, when you go to Oxford to get a degree in English literature, as I have, people always want to know who your favorite English author is. The press team compiled a list of acceptable answers. They wanted a realist, so I suggested George Eliot. No, Eliot was actually Marianne Evans under a pen name, not a strong male author. They wanted one of the inventors of the English novel, so I suggested Daniel Defoe. No, he was a dissenter from the Church of England. At one point, I threw out Jonathan Swift, just to watch the collective coronary they had at the thought of an Irish political satirist. In the end, they picked Dickens. Which is hilarious. They wanted something less fruity than the truth. But truly, what is gayer than a woman who languishes away in a crumbling mansion wearing her wedding gown every day of her life for the drama? The fruity truth? My favorite English author is Jane Austen. So, to borrow a passage from Sense and Sensibility, you want nothing but patience, or give it a more fascinating name. Call it hope. To paraphrase, I hope to see you put your green American money where your filthy mouth is soon. Yours, in sexual frustration, Henry. Alex feels like somebody has probably warned him about private email servers before, but he's a little fuzzy on the details. It doesn't feel important. At first, like most things that require time when instant gratification is possible, he doesn't see the point of Henry's emails. But when Richards tells Sean Hannity that his mother hasn't accomplished anything as president, Alex screams into his elbow and goes back to,
The way you speak sometimes is like sugar spilling out of a bag with a hole in the bottom.
When Waspy Hunter brings up the Harvard rowing team for the fifth time in one workday,
your arse in those trousers is a crime.
When he's tired of being touched by strangers,
come back to me when you're done being flung through the firmament, you lost Pleiad.
Now he gets it. His dad wasn't wrong about how ugly things would get with Richards leading the ticket. Utah ugly. Christian ugly. Ugliness couched in dog whistles and toothy white smiles. Right-wing think pieces about entitlement thrown in his and June's direction, reeking of, Mexicans stole the first family jobs too. He can't allow the fear of losing in. He drinks coffee, and brings his policy work on the campaign trail, and drinks more coffee, reads emails from Henry, and drinks even more coffee. The first D.C. pride since his bisexual awakening happens while Alex is in Nevada, and he spends the day jealously checking Twitter. Confetti raining down on the mall, Grand Marshal Rafael Luna with a rainbow bandana around his head. He goes back to his hotel and talks to his minibar about it. The biggest bright spot in all the chaos is that his lobbying with one of the campaign chairs, and his own mother, has finally paid off. They're doing a massive rally at Minute Maid Park in Houston. Polls are shifting in directions they've never seen before. Politico's top story of the week is 2020 the year Texas becomes a true battleground state. Yes, I will make sure everyone knows the Houston rally was your idea, his mother says, barely paying attention, as she goes over her speech on the plane to Texas. You should say grit, not fortitude there, June says, reading the speech over her shoulder. Texans like grit. Can y'all both go sit somewhere else? She says, but she adds a note. Alex knows a lot of the campaign is skeptical, even when they've seen the numbers. So when they pull up to Minute Maid and the line wraps around the block twice, he feels beyond gratified. He feels smug. His mom gets up to make her speech to thousands, and Alex thinks, hell yeah, Texas, prove the bastards wrong. He's still riding high when he swipes his badge at the door of the campaign office the following Monday. He's been getting tired of sitting at a desk and going through focus groups again and again and again, but he's ready to pick the fight back up. The fact that he rounds the corner into his cubicle to find Waspy Hunter holding the Texas binder brings him right the fuck back down. Oh, you left this on your desk, Waspy Hunter says casually. I thought maybe it was a new project they were putting us on. Do I go on your side of the cubicle and turn off your Dropkick Murphy Spotify station no matter how much I want to? Alex demands. No, Hunter, I don't. Well, you do kind of steal my pencils a lot. Alex snatches the binder away before he can finish. It's private. What is it? Waspy Hunter asks as Alex shoves it back into his bag. He can't believe he left it out. All that data and the district lines. What are you doing with all that?
Nothing. Is it about the Houston rally you pushed for?
Houston was a good idea, he says, instantly defensive.
Dude, you don't honestly think Texas can go blue, do you? It's one of the most backward states in the country.
You're from Boston, Hunter. You really want to talk about all the places bigotry comes from?
Look, man, I'm just saying.
You know what? Alex says. You think y'all are off the hook for institutional bigotry because you come from a blue state. Not every white supremacist is a meth head in bumfuck Mississippi. There are plenty of them at Duke or UPenn on daddy's money. Waspy Hunter looks startled, but not convinced.
None of that changes that red states have been red forever, he says, laughing, like it's something to joke about.
And none of those populations seem to care enough about what's good for them to vote. Maybe those populations might be more motivated to vote if we made an actual effort to campaign to them and showed them that we care, and how our platform is designed to help them, not leave them behind, Alex says hotly. Imagine if nobody who claims to have your interests at heart ever came to your state and tried to talk to you, man. Or if you were a felon, or fucking voter ID laws, people who can't access polls, who can't leave work to get to one.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be great if we could magically mobilize every eligible marginalized voter in red states, but political campaigns have a finite amount of time and resources. And we have to prioritize based on projections.
Waspy Hunter says, as if Alex, the first son of the United States, is unfamiliar with how campaigns work.
There just aren't the same numbers of bigots in blue states. If they don't want to be left behind, maybe people in red states should do something about it.
And Alex has, quite frankly, had it.
Did you forget that you're working on the campaign of someone Texas fucking created?
He says, and his voice has officially risen to the point where staffers in the neighboring cubicles are staring, but he doesn't care.
Why don't we talk about how there's a chapter of the Klan in every state? You think there aren't racists and homophobes growing up in Vermont? Man, I appreciate that you're doing the work here, but you're not special. You don't get to sit up here and pretend it's someone else's problem. None of us do.
He takes his bag and his binder and storms out. The minute he's outside the building, he pulls out his phone on impulse, opens up Google. There are test dates this month. He knows there are. LSAT, Washington, D.C. Area Test Center, he types. Group chat. Three geniuses and Alex, June 23rd, 2020, 12:34 p.m. Juniper. Bug.
Not my name, not anyone's name. Stop.
Leading member of Korean pop band BTS, Kim Nam-joon. Bug.
I'm blocking your number.
HRH Prince Dickhead, poop emoji.
Alex, please don't tell me Pez has indoctrinated you with K-pop.
Well, you let Nora get into your drag race, so...
IRL Chaos Demon. Latrice Royale, eat it, Jif.
Bug.
What did you want, Alex?
Where's my speech for Milwaukee?
I know you took it.
HRH Prince Dickhead poop emoji.
Must you have this conversation in the group chat?
Bug.
Part of it needed to be rewritten.
I put it back with edits in the outside pocket of your messenger bag.
Davis is going to kill you if you keep doing this.
Bug.
Davis saw how well my tweaks to the talking points went over on Seth Meyers last week, so he knows better.
Why is there a rock in here, too?
Bug.
That is a clear quartz crystal for clarity and good vibes. Do not at me.
We need all the help we can get right now.
Stop putting spells on my stuff.
IRL Chaos Demon.
Burn the witch.
IRL Chaos Demon.
Hey, what do we think of this hashtag look for the college voter thing tomorrow?
IRL Chaos Demon. Attached image.
IRL Chaos Demon. I'm going for, like, depressed lesbian poet who met a hot yoga instructor at a speakeasy who got her super into meditation and pottery, and now she's starting a new life as a high-powered businesswoman selling her own line of hand-thrown fruit balls.
Dot.
Dot.
Dot. HRH Prince Dickhead poop emoji.
Bitch, you took me there.
Asks this Jif adds job.
Nora, you broke him.
IRL Chaos Demon.
LMAO.
The invitation comes certified airmail straight from Buckingham Palace. Gilded edges, spindly calligraphy. The chairman and committee of management of the championships request the pleasure of the company of Alexander Clermont Diaz in the Royal Box on the 6th of July, 2020. Alex takes a picture and texts it to Henry. 1.
The fuck is this? Aren't there poor people in your country?
2. I've already been in the Royal Box. Henry sends back,
"You are a delinquent and a plague."
And then,
"Please come."
And here Alex is, spending his one day off from the campaign at Wimbledon, only to get his body next to Henry's again.
So, as I've warned you, Henry says as they approach the doors to the Royal Box, Philip will be here, and assorted other nobility with whom you may have to make conversation. People named Basil.
I think I've proven that I can handle royals. Henry looks doubtful.
You're brave. I could use some of that.
The sun is, for once, bright over London when they step outside, flooding the stands around them, which have already mostly filled with spectators. He notices David Beckham in a well-tailored suit. Once again, how had he convinced himself he was straight? Before David Beckham turns away, and Alex sees it was Bea he was talking to, her face bright when she spots them.
Oi!
Alex! Henry! She chirps over the murmur of the box. She's a vision in a lime-green, drop-waist silk dress, a pair of huge, round Gucci sunglasses embellished with gold honeybees perched on her nose. You look gorgeous, Alex says, accepting a kiss on his cheek.
Why, thank you, darling,
Bee says. She takes one of their arms in each of hers and whisks them off down the steps.
Your sister helped me pick the dress, actually. It's McQueen. She's a genius, did you know?
I've been made aware.
Here we are,
Bee says when they've reached the front row.
These are ours.
Henry looks at the lush green cushions of the seats topped with thick and shiny Wimbledon 2020 programs right at the front edge of the box.
Front and center,
he says with a note of nervousness.
Really?
Yes, Henry. In case you have forgotten, you are a royal, and this is the royal box.
She waves down to the photographers below, who are already snapping photos of them, before leaning into them and whispering,
Don't worry. I don't think they can detect the thick air of Horntown betwixt you two from the lawn.
Ha ha, Bee. Henry monotones, ears pink, and despite his apprehension, he takes his seat between Alex and Bee. He keeps his elbows carefully tucked into his sides and out of Alex's space. It's halfway through the day when Philip and Martha arrive, Philip looking as generically handsome as ever. Alex wonders how such rich genetics conspire to make Bee and Henry both so interesting to look at, all mischievous smiles and swooping cheekbones, but punted so hard on Philip. He looks like a stock photo.
Morning, Philip says as he takes his reserved seat to the side of Bee.
His eyes track over Alex twice, and Alex can sense skepticism as to why Alex was even allowed. Maybe it's weird Alex is here. He doesn't care. Martha's looking at him weird, too, but maybe she's simply holding a grudge about her wedding cake.
Afternoon, Pip, Bee says politely. Martha.
Beside him, Henry's spine stiffens. Henry, Philip says. Henry's hand is tense on the program in his lap.
Good to see you, mate. Been a bit busy, have you?
Gap year and all that. There's an implication under his tone. Where exactly have you been? What exactly have you been doing? A muscle flexes in Henry's jaw.
Yes, Henry says. Loads of work with Percy. It's been mad.
Right. The Okonjo Foundation, isn't it? He says. Shame he couldn't make it today. Suppose we'll have to make do with our American friend, then.
At that, he tips a dry smile at Alex. Yep, Alex says, too loud. He grins broadly.
Though I do suppose Percy would look a bit out of place in the box, wouldn't he?
Philip,
Bee says.
Oh, don't be so dramatic, Bee,
Philip says dismissively.
I only mean he's a peculiar sort, isn't he? Those frocks he wears, a bit much for Wimbledon.
Henry's face is calm and genial, but one of his knees has shifted over to dig into Alex's.
They're called Taishikis, Philip, and he wore one once.
Right, Philip says. You know, I don't judge. I just think, you know. Remember when we were younger and you spent time with my mates from uni? Or Lady Agatha's son, the one that's always quail hunting? You could consider more mates of similar standing.
Henry's mouth is a thin line, but he says nothing.
We can't all be mates with the Count of Montpezat like you, Philip,
Bee mutters.
In any event, Philip presses on, ignoring her. You're unlikely to find a wife unless you're running in the right circles, aren't you?
He chuckles a little and returns to watching the match.
If you'll excuse me, Henry says.
He drops his program in his seat and vanishes. 10 minutes later, Alex finds him in the clubhouse by a gigantic vase of lurid fuchsia flowers. His eyes are intent on Alex the moment he sees him. His lip chewed the same furious red as the embroidered Union Jack on his pocket square.
Hello, Alex,
he says placidly. Alex takes his tone. Hi.
Has anyone shown you round the clubhouse yet?
Nope.
Well then.
Henry touches two fingers to the back of his elbow, and Alex obeys immediately. Down a flight of stairs, through a concealed side door and a second hidden corridor,
There is a small room full of chairs and tablecloths and one old, abandoned tennis racket. As soon as the door is closed behind them, Henry slams him up against it. He gets right up in Alex's space, but he doesn't kiss him. He hovers there, a breath away, his hands at Alex's hips and his mouth split open in a crooked smirk.
"Do you know what I want?"
he says, his voice so low and hot that it burns right through Alex's solar plexus, right into the core of him.
"What?" "I want," he says, "to do the absolute last thing I'm supposed to be doing right now."
Alex juts out his chin, grinningly defiant.
"Then tell me to do it, sweetheart."
And Henry, tonguing the corner of his own mouth, tugs hard to undo Alex's belt and says,
"Fuck me."
"Well," Alex grunts, "when at Wimbledon."
Henry laughs hoarsely and leans down to kiss him, open-mouthed and eager. He's moving fast, knowing they're on borrowed time, quick to follow the lead when Alex groans and pulls at his shoulders to change their positions. He gets Henry's back to his chest, Henry's palms braced against the door. "Just so we're clear," Alex says, "I'm about to have sex with you in this storage closet to spite your family. Like, that's what's happening." Henry, who has apparently been carrying his travel-size lube with him this entire time in his jacket, says,
"Right,"
and tosses it over his shoulder.
"Awesome. Fucking love doing things out of spite,"
he says, without a hint of sarcasm, and he kicks Henry's feet apart. And it should be funny. It should be hot, stupid, ridiculous, obscene, another wild sexual adventure to add to the list. And it is, but it shouldn't also feel like last time, like Alex might die if it ever stops. There's a laugh in his mouth, but it won't get past his tongue, because he knows this is him helping Henry get through something. Rebellion.
"You're brave. I could use some of that."
After, he kisses Henry's mouth fiercely, pushes his fingers deep into Henry's hair, sucks the air out of him. Henry smiles breathlessly against his neck, looking extremely pleased with himself, and says,
"I'm rather finished with tennis, aren't you?"
So they steal away behind a crowd, blocked by PPOs and umbrellas, and back at Kensington, Henry brings Alex up to his rooms. His apartment is a sprawling warren of 22 rooms on the northwest side of the palace, closest to the orangery. He splits it with Bea, but there's not much of either of them in any of the high ceilings and heavy jacquard furniture. What is there is more B than Henry. A leather jacket flung over the back of a chaise, Mr. Wobbles preening in a corner, a 17th-century Dutch oil painting on one landing literally called Woman at Her Toilet that only B would have selected from the royal collection. Henry's bedroom is as cavernous and opulent and insufferably beige as Alex could have imagined, with a gilded Baroque bed and windows overlooking the gardens. He watches Henry shrug out of his suit and imagines having to live with it, wondering if Henry simply isn't allowed to choose what his rooms look like, or if he never wanted to ask for something different. All those nights Henry can't sleep, just knocking around these endless, impersonal rooms like a bird trapped in a museum. The only room that really feels like both Henry and B is a small parlor on the second floor converted into a music studio. The colors are richest here. Hand-woven Turkish rugs in deep reds and violets, a tobacco-colored settee, little poofs and tables of knick-knacks spring up like mushrooms, and the walls are lined with Stratocasters and flying Vs, violins, an assortment of harps, one stout cello propped up in the corner. In the center of the room is the grand piano, and Henry sits down at it and plucks away idly, toying with a melody of something that sounds like an old song by the Killers. David the Beagle naps quietly near the pedals.
"Play something I don't know," Alex says.
Back in high school in Texas, Alex was the most cultured of the jock crowd because he was a book nerd, a politics junkie, the only varsity letterman debating the finer points of Dred Scott in AP US history. He listens to Nina Simone and Otis Redding, likes expensive whiskey. But Henry's got an entirely different compendium of knowledge. so he just listens and nods and smiles a little while Henry explains that this is what Brahms sounds like, and this is Wagner, and how they're on the two opposing sides of the Romantic movement.
Do you hear the difference there?
His hands are fast, almost effortless, even as he goes off into a tangent about the War of the Romantics and how Liszt's daughter left her husband for Wagner.
Quel scandale!
He switches to an Alexander Scriabin sonata, winking over at Alex at the composer's first name. The Andante, the third movement, is his favorite, he explains, because he read once that it was written to evoke the image of a castle in ruins, which he found darkly funny at the time. He goes quiet, focused, lost in the piece for long minutes. Then, without warning, it changes again, turbulent chords circling back into something familiar. The Elton John songbook. Henry closes his eyes, playing from memory. It's your song.
Oh.
And Alex's heart doesn't spread itself out in his chest. And he doesn't have to grip the edge of the settee to steady himself, because that's what he would do if he were here in this palace to fall in love with Henry, and not just continuing this thing where they fly across the world to touch each other and don't talk about it. That's not why he's here. It's not. They make out lazily for what could be hours on the settee. Alex wants to do it on the piano, but it's a priceless antique or whatever. And then they stagger up to Henry's room, the palatial bed. Henry lets Alex take him apart with painstaking patience and precision, moans the name of God so many times that the room feels consecrated. It pushes Henry over some kind of edge, melted and overwhelmed on the lush bedclothes. Alex spends nearly an hour afterward coaxing little tremors out of him, in awe of his elaborate expressions of wonder and blissful agony, ghosting feather-like fingertips over his collarbone, his ankles, the insides of his knees, the small bones of the backs of his hands, the dip of his lower lip. He touches and touches until he brings Henry to another brink with only his fingertips, only his breath on the inside of his thighs, the promise of Alex's mouth where he'd pressed his fingers before. Henry says the same two words from the secret room at Wimbledon, this time dressed up in,
"Please, I need you to."
He still can't believe Henry can talk like this, that he gets to be the only one who hears it. So he does. When they come back down, Henry practically passes out on his chest without another word, fucked out and boneless, and Alex laughs to himself and pets his sweaty hair and listens to the soft snores that come almost immediately. It takes him hours to fall asleep, though. Henry drools on him. David finds his way onto the bed and curls up at their feet. Alex has to be back on a plane for DNC prep in a matter of hours, but he can't sleep. It's jet lag. It's just jet lag. He remembers, as if from a million miles away, telling Henry once not to overthink this.
As your president, Jeffrey Richards is saying on one of the flat screens in the campaign office, one of my priorities will be encouraging young people to get involved with their government. If we're going to hold our control of the Senate and take back the House, we need the next generation to stand up and join the fight.
The College Republicans of Vanderbilt University cheer on the live feed, and Alex pretends to barf onto his latest policy draft.
Why don't you come up here, Brittany?
A pretty blonde student joins Richard at the podium, and he puts an arm around her.
Brittany here was the main organizer we worked with for this event, and she couldn't have done a better job getting us this amazing turnout.
More cheers. A mid-level staffer lobs a ball of paper at the screen.
It's young people like Brittany who give us hope for the future of our party, which is why I'm pleased to announce that as president, I'll be launching the Richards Youth Congress Program. Other politicians don't want people, especially discerning young people like you, to get up close in our offices and see just how the sausage gets made.
I want to see a cage match between your grandmother and this fucking ghoul running against my mom, Alex texts Henry as he turns back to his cubicle. It's the last days before the DNC, and he hasn't been able to catch the coffee pot before it's empty in a week. The policy inboxes are overflowing since they released the official platform 2 days ago, and Waspy Hunter has been firing off emails like his life depends on it. He hasn't said anything else to Alex about his rant from last month, but he has started wearing headphones to spare Alex his musical choices. He types out another text, this one to Luna. Can you please go on Anderson Cooper or something and explain that paragraph you ghostwrote on tax law for the platform so people will stop asking? Ain't got the time, Vato. He's been texting Luna all week, ever since the Richards campaign leaked that they've tapped an independent senator for his prospective cabinet. The old bastard Stanley Connor flat out denied every last request for an endorsement. By the end, Luna privately told Alex they were lucky Connor didn't try to primary them. Nothing's official, but everyone knows Connor is the one joining Richards' ticket. But if Luna knows when the announcement's coming, he's not sharing. It's a week. The polls aren't great. Paul Ryan is getting sanctimonious about the Second Amendment, and there's some salon hot take going around. Would Ellen Claremont have gotten elected if she weren't conventionally beautiful? If it weren't for her morning meditation sessions, Alex is sure his mom would have throttled an aide by now. For his part, he misses Henry's bed, Henry's body, Henry, and a place a few thousand miles removed from the factory line of the campaign. That night after Wimbledon from a week ago feels like something out of a dream now. All the more tantalizing because Henry is in New York for a few days with Pez to do paperwork for an LGBT youth shelter in Brooklyn. There aren't enough hours in the day for Alex to find a pretense to get there. And no matter how much the world enjoys their public friendship, they're running out of plausible excuses to be seen together. This time is nothing like their first breathless trip to the DNC in 2016. His dad had been the delegate to cast the votes from California that put her over, and they all cried. Alex and June introduced their mother before her acceptance speech, and June's hands were shaking, but his were steady. The crowd roared, and Alex's heart roared back. This year, they're all frizzy-haired and exhausted from trying to run the country and a campaign simultaneously, and even one day of the DNC is a stretch. On the second night of the convention, they pile into Air Force One to New York. It'd be Marine One, but they won't all fit in one helicopter. Have you run a cost-benefit analysis on this? Zara is saying into her phone as they take off, because you know I'm right, and these assets can be transferred at any time if you disagree.
Yes. Yeah, I know.
Okay. That's what I thought. A long pause, then, under her breath,
love you too.
Alex says when she's hung up, something you'd like to share with the class? Zara doesn't even look up from her phone.
Yes, that was my boyfriend, and no, you may not ask me any further questions about him.
June has shut her journal in sudden interest.
How could you possibly have a boyfriend we don't know about?
I see you more than I see clean underwear, Alex says.
You're not changing your underwear often enough, sugar.
His mother interjects from across the cabin. I go commando a lot, Alex says dismissively.
Is this like a my Canadian girlfriend thing? Does he...
He does very animated air quotes.
Go to a different school?
You really are determined to get shoved out of an emergency hatch one day, huh? She says. It's long distance, but not like that. No more questions. Cash jumps in, too, insisting he deserves to know as the resident love guru of the staff. And there's a debate about appropriate information to share with your coworkers, which is laughable considering how much Cash already knows about Alex's personal life. They're circling New York when June suddenly stops talking, focused again on Zara, who has gone silent.
Zara?
Alex turns and sees Zara sitting perfectly still. Such a departure from her usual constant motion that everyone else freezes too. She's staring at her phone, mouth open.
Zara,
his mother echoes now, deadly serious.
What?
She looks up finally, her grip on her phone tight. The Post just broke the name of the independent senator joining Richards's cabinet, she says. It's not Stanley Connor. It's Raphael Luna. No, June is saying. Her heels are dangling from her hand, her eyes bright in the warm light near the hotel elevator where they've agreed to meet. Her hair is coming out of its braid in angry spikes.
You're damn lucky I agreed to talk to you in the first place, so you get this or you get nothing.
The Post reporter blinks, fingers faltering on his recorder. He's been hounding June on her personal phone since the minute they landed in New York for a quote about the convention, and now he's demanding something about Luna. June is not typically an angry person, but it's been a long day, and she looks about 3 seconds from using one of those heels to stab the guy through the eye socket.
What about you?
The guy asks Alex.
If she's not giving it to you, I'm not giving it to you, Alex says. She's much nicer than me.
June snaps her fingers in front of the guy's hipster glasses, eyes blazing.
You don't get to speak to him, June says. Here is my quote. My mother, the president, still fully intends to win this race. We're here to support her and to encourage the party to stay united behind her.
But about Senator Luna?
Thank you. Vote Claremont,
June says tightly, slapping her hand over Alex's mouth. She sweeps him off and into the waiting elevator, elbowing him when he licks her palm.
That goddamn fucking traitor, Alex says when they reach their floor. Duplicitous fucking bastard! I fucking helped him get elected! I canvassed for him for 27 hours straight. I went to his sister's wedding. I memorized his goddamn Five Guys order.
I fucking know, Alex, June says, shoving her key card into the slot.
How did that vampire weekend-looking little shit even have your personal number?
June throws her shoes at the bed, and they bounce off onto the floor in different directions.
Because I slept with him last year, Alex, how do you think?
You're not the only one who makes stupid sexual decisions when you're stressed out. She drops onto the bed and starts taking off her earrings.
I just don't understand what the point is. Like, what is Luna's endgame here? Is he some kind of fucking sleeper agent sent from the future to give me an ulcer?
It's late. They got into New York after 9, hurtling into crisis management meetings for hours. Alex still feels wired, but when June looks up at him, he can see some of the brightness in her eyes has started to look like frustrated tears, and he softens a little.
If I had to guess, Luna thinks we're going to lose,
he tells her quietly, and he thinks he can push Richards farther left by joining the ticket, like putting the fire out from inside the house. June looks at him, eyes tired, searching his face. She may be the oldest, but politics is Alex's game, not hers. He knows he would have chosen this life for himself, given the option. He knows she wouldn't have.
I think I need to sleep. For like the next year, at least. Wake me up after the general.
Okay, bug, Alex says. He leans down to kiss the top of her head.
I can do that. Thanks, baby bro.
Don't call me that.
Tiny, miniature, itty-bitty baby brother.
Fuck off.
Go to bed.
Cash is waiting for him out in the hallway, his suit abandoned for plain clothes.
Hanging in there?
He asks Alex.
I mean, I kind of have to.
Cash pats him on the shoulder with one gigantic hand.
There's a bar downstairs.
Alex considers. Yeah. Okay. The Beekman is thankfully quiet this late, and the bar is low-lit with warm, rich shades of gold on the walls and deep green leather on the high-backed bar stools. Alex orders a whiskey, neat. He looks at his phone, swallowing down his frustration with the whiskey. He texted Luna 3 hours ago, a succinct, what the fuck? An hour ago, he got back,
I don't expect you to understand.
He wants to call Henry. He guesses it makes sense. They've always been fixed points in each other's worlds, little magnetic poles. Some laws of physics would be reassuring right now.
God, whiskey makes him maudlin.
He orders another. He's contemplating texting Henry, even though he's probably somewhere over the Atlantic, when a voice curls around his ear, smooth and warm. He's sure he must be imagining it.
I'll have a gin and tonic, thanks.
It says.
And there's Henry, in the flesh, sidled up next to him at the bar, looking a little tousled in a soft gray button-down and jeans.
Alex wonders for an insane second if his brain has conjured up some kind of stress-induced sex mirage when Henry says, voice lowered,
You looked rather tragic drinking alone.
Definitely the real Henry, then. You're... What are you doing here?
You know, as a figurehead of one of the most powerful countries in the world, I do manage to keep abreast on international politics. Alex raises an eyebrow. Henry inclines his head, sheepish. I sent Pez home without me because I was worried.
There it is,
Alex says with a wink. He goes for his drink to hide what he suspects is a small, sad smile. The ice clacks against his teeth.
Speak not the bastard's name.
Cheers, Henry says, as the bartender returns with his drink. Henry takes the first sip, sucking lime juice off his thumb, and fuck, he looks good. There's color in his cheeks and lips, the glow of Brooklyn summertime warmth that his English blood isn't accustomed to. He looks like something soft and downy Alex wants to sink into, and he realizes the knot of anxiety in his chest has finally slackened. It's rare anyone other than Shun goes out of their way to check on him. It's by his own design, mostly a barricade of charm and fitful monologues and hard-headed independence. Henry looks at him like he's not fooled by any of it.
Get moving on that drink, Wales, Alex says. I've got a king-size bed upstairs that's calling my name.
He shifts on his stool, letting one of his knees graze against Henry's under the bar, nudging them apart.
Henry squints at him. Bossy.
They sit there until Henry finishes his drink, Alex listening to the placating murmur of Henry talking about different brands of gin, thankful that for once Henry seems happy to carry the conversation alone. He closes his eyes, wills the disaster of the day away, and tries to forget. He remembers Henry's words in the garden months ago.
Do you ever wonder what it's like to be some anonymous person out in the world?
If he's some anonymous, normal person removed from history, he's 22 and he's tipsy and he's pulling a guy into his hotel room by the belt loop.